Yeah, first of all, pay attention to the Tillum announcement there. Put up the uncle of one of your friends to say Tillum 4. I changed the topic this week. As I mentioned, I like to be able to be spontaneous and flexible a little bit. I don't know. I get into trouble that way, actually, but it's still a topic comes up during the week, something I've been talking to people about or thinking about or looking into, so I like to do that. But I want to get back to this topic of taking care of ourselves, because it is a very important one in many ways. And then we're going to have to think a little bit about Hanukkah and Christianity. I think those are two topics that we got to deal with heading toward holiday specials toward the end of the month and such. So we have to understand the two, the Hanukkah and the anti-Hanukkah, if you want to call it that, and try to see what our attitudes are or should be during the holiday season. The reason I picked Shlichus for today is obviously the idea of Shlichus goes far beyond the official format of what's known as Chabad Shlichus. But nonetheless, everybody's talking and thinking about the idea, the picture of Shlichim in the world, right, as the couple, Hashem Yikom Domam, that we found yesterday, you know, many people at the Levaya, and to see, and a person gets in their head the following question, which is, why am I not a Shlich? In other words, maybe nobody else gets these questions. I don't know, I've heard people bouncing it around. What does that mean, why am I not a Shlich? It means that seems, and is, definitely is, so noble, right, so incredible to just get up and go off with total self-sacrifice to where Jews are or may be and can be contacted. I don't know if people are clued in on the scene in India, right, but India for Israelis is almost like taking the bus to Haifa. A huge percentage of Israelis take trips after the army. The common destinations for the trips are either South America, where they tend to do really crazy, dangerous things. Right? I spoke with somebody from South America who says they keep having problems. The Israelis come over there and get killed in the jungle because they're doing all sorts of kooky stuff. America, sometimes, where they get jobs off the books for all the moving companies you see around in every big city. Moishe's movers, Golan movers, you know, something like that. It's all Israeli guys after the army who are doing this, and they have a whole system of going from city to city, working for the moving company, making some cash and moving on. Perhaps the biggest destination is the Far East. The Far East, especially India, certain areas of India, Goa, Kathmandu, other places where they go, Nepal, and this has become a part of the Israeli journey. Strangely enough, Israelis who travel from Israel elsewhere are often more able to come in touch with their Judaism than when they're here. Right? This is a little counterintuitive to us, because we're all people who got on the plane and came to Israel to get in touch with our Torah and Judaism. And it seems very strange to us that people would go to a country of a bunch of Avodah Zarah worshiping wackos to get in touch with their Judaism. But that's the way it happens, when you're lucky. Okay, I'm not recommending to anybody to tell people, why don't you go to India to get in touch with your Judaism, because many people simply, you know, mess up with different pharmaceutical substances and with real Avodah Zarah and a lot of other bad stuff that can happen there. Nonetheless, the phenomena of people who've gotten in touch with these things on these trips is incredible. And it's something which is important for us as well. Really, there is a common denominator between their journey and your journey. Your journey was separating yourself from so many things that were familiar to you and comfortable to you. And in doing that, part of the power of a journey is to enable a person to see, who am I? Who am I? How do I define myself when I have no points of reference? There's a kooky thing. Maybe it's not kooky, I don't know, it sounds kind of spooky to me. That people pay a lot of money to do, it's called a sensory deprivation tank. People familiar with that? Sensory deprivation tank is built like this. It's totally light-proof, totally soundproof, it's filled with water with a certain amount of salt in it at exact body temperature, 98 point whatever, which is supposed to be when you're healthy. And it's kind of like the Yam HaMelech thing, only not so salty that it hurts your cuts. And you go in there and you get closed up in it and you float. There's no light, there's no sun, you can't bring your cell phone in, right? And there's like almost no sensation because it's almost like you're in the womb. Why do people pay a lot of money to do this? Because they want to get a sense of themselves outside their body. Right? So much we kind of define our existence by input. How do I know I'm alive? I pinched myself. Right? That classic thing. How do I know I'm not dreaming? I pinched myself. Oh, it hurt. Therefore, I am. I smell supper. Right? I feel this or that. I see. I hear. With none of that, do you still exist? Who are you? Probably give me the screaming willies. But some people seem to find it useful to get shut up in that thing. The idea of a journey of a nesiyah, right, has always been part of Am Yisrael's Mesorah in terms of those things. The most extreme form of it, for those people who are real ninja Avodas Hashem people, is to take upon itself a golus. Right? We find that a variety of Gedolei Yisrael over the generations used to take golus. The Vilna Gaon did it for a certain period of time. There are different formats of it. The basic format of golus is traveling incognito. You travel so that nobody knows who you are. You go to places where nobody knows you. And in its strongest form, you don't stay in one place more than one night. Right? That idea of golus, which some people take upon themselves for kapara, if they felt that they had a need to work themselves over for kapara, not in terms of suffering, you could sit at home and hit yourself with a baseball bat for that, but in terms of detaching yourself from that sense of self or ego, which may be unhealthy. And that idea of traveling in separation, which is there, that's there in the form of golus. So really, you're traveling to Eretz Yisrael, they're traveling to India or to other countries where there are, is in a sense taking yourself out of all familiar things and seeing what you find. And what many of them find is that they're a Jew. And that they discovered that the fact that they're a Jew is much more important to them than they ever discovered. And oftentimes the necessary ingredient in that is to have a Jew there to meet you. To have a Jew there to meet you and to look at you as a Jew. And the sense of discovery that a person feels where a person realizes how powerful that is to you is very important. One anecdote, one of my students, I used to work with Israeli guys who virtually all of them went on these journeys. So one of them told me, he said he was in the Chabad house in Thailand. Right? The Chabad house in Bangkok is a major destination, especially because you often pass through Thailand on the way to a lot of these things. And he met a friend of his who just spent a year in India. So he said to him, he said, what was like the high point of your trip? He said, there was one Shabbos that was in a Chabad house in wherever, Kathmandu or something, and they let me make Kiddush for everybody. And this guy told me, he said, this guy's just been hiking up mountains, watching a variety of different shaven-headed weirdos, you know, twisting themselves into pretzels, seeing amazing views, doing all sorts of different things. What was the high point of his whole trip? He got to make Kiddush for a bunch of other Jews. That's what I mean by this journey of discovery. Discovering something like that is very important. In youth hostels throughout India, you find little breathless pamphlets and tapes, right, that are just sitting there from one to the other, passed around in different ways, and it can be important. Another interesting anecdote of discovery, one from America. A student of mine went, he told me after the army, so he went to America again, they call it Menakot et Harosh. You want to clear the head. You want to get away from all the things that you knew and such. He was there, he said he went with a couple of friends, and they were doing the moving thing. They would work as movers in one city, make some money, move to another city. Eventually, they ended up in Seattle. Anybody from Seattle? No, Seattletonians, whatever they are. Anyway, and they got to Seattle. In Seattle, they were waiting to make good money working on salmon boats. During the salmon fishing season, some very difficult work you can do, but you can make good money working on them. And he said then, something unexpected happened. The two friends he was traveling with, both of them met non-Jewish women and got married to them. Bang, quickly, instant green card, instant citizenship, lots of goodies, right? So they were gone. So he said, there I was alone, I was low on money, and I was stuck in Seattle. Now the second half of the story was that he had a sister who had kind of rebelled at high school age. They were kind of from a weak traditional Sephardi family, and she decided for some reason she wanted to go to like Beis Yaakov or something. And she didn't. She married a Skelena Chassid and ended up living in Borough Park. So he said during the whole trip, he never had this particular urge to visit his sister. But then at that point, he said, you know what, why not? So he came to her apartment in Borough Park. He said, in a matter of a couple hours, I was going out of my mind. Small apartment, lots of kids, no television. Right? I didn't know what to do with myself. So she told him, listen, there's a rabbi here who gives shiurim in Hebrew to Israelis. Why don't you go? And that was his connection. Right? Many of these different times. So the people who are out there, and it's not just Chabad, by the way, there are other people who are out there in India and all sorts of different places who have these houses that people can come to, who are giving shurim, who are going around to the popular places. They are that connection at times when people are open. Likewise, in America recently, many of you must have bumped into or seen what's happening on the college campuses now. A group of very wealthy Jews got together and decided that in order to stem the tide of assimilation, the only time virtually, or the best time to be able to do that, is when Jewish kids are in university. It's a time when people are thinking, they're exploring, they're looking for something new, they're open to trying things. Mommy and daddy aren't necessarily sitting on top of them. And this, I heard once a speech by Rabbi Beryl Wein years ago, where he cried out, he said, we will be held accountable for this. He said, there are thousands upon thousands of kids in Jewish campuses. I spoke to a young woman this week who told me that in her campus in Florida, I forget what it was called, Florida State University, in Gainesboro, Florida, Florida something, university, there are 6,000 Jewish kids. 6,000 Jewish kids. And the question is anybody out there to do something for them? He said, we'll be held accountable if we do not have people there for them to meet. And again, right, certainly, you know, you can't ignore the fact that this is walking in the footsteps of Chabad, who did this many years before. On the other hand, it is important to have alternatives to Chabad, because that's not necessarily for everyone at the time. So there are a lot of now couples, what they call campus rabbis, mini kollelim in different places. University of Wisconsin in Madison, which also has thousands of Jewish kids, has six couples living on the campus area, more or less. They have a small kollel. They do all these things. So it's a tremendous amount of work which is there, and it is making a difference. There's absolutely no question that all these people out there are making a difference. So people start to think, should I be doing that? Right? Is that for me? Should I become, and the amount of self-sacrifice involved here is hard to imagine. Right? These people who are out there, he shechted 100 chickens a week in India because there was no way to get kosher chickens. His wife cleaned them and kashered them, and they served, you know, 400 meals a week, I think, or something like that. They wanted pasi soil. She baked bread for hundreds of people every week. Their children oftentimes are educated now with the internet, so there's a Lubavitch homeschooling site so that shlichim around the world can homeschool their kids in a virtual cheder, right? That each kid sits there, you know, in his place with a microphone in front of the computer wherever he is in the Chabad house of Timbuktu, you know, and learns together with all the other little Mendes and Dove Bears around the world, right? And you know, does these things. So these are things of tremendous sacrifice. Many of the other people find this in terms of sacrificing in this way. It's an interesting question. For some people, it definitely is a mission. Oftentimes, maybe only for a certain type of life, for a certain period in your life. Some people, when they're newly married, where the issue of chinuch is not that much, sometimes it's a challenge which is not right for many people. And there are problems. It's not necessarily easy to pluck a guy out of yeshiva and send him hanging out on a university campus with everybody. Right? There was one guy who came to our yeshiva. He was from a university. What was it? University of Southern California in Santa Cruz, I think it was. And I told him, I said, you know, it's probably like this kind of, you know, stupid Eastern stereotype I have. I always imagine a university in Southern California being a bunch of people walking around with surfboards, you know, and all these kind of things. He said, yeah, no, there it is. That's exactly what it's like, you know. So you take some guy from the mirror, you airlift him down there, right into this. You know, it's not exactly, you know, the something everyone is prepared for. A person has to be prepared for it well and properly if you're doing it. But what I want to talk about, and it's based on a Sfasemis in this week's parasha, is the fact that everybody's a shliach. Everybody's a shliach, and it's very important for everyone to have the sense of shlichus in their lives in each thing that they're doing without necessarily having to do something storybook like moving up to a mountaintop someplace in the middle of nowhere. And that which we feel, if a person through the events of the past week felt a swelling of admiration toward people who are shlichim, and felt a swelling of almost a fantasy type of desire, you know, maybe I wish I could do something like that for the Jewish people, felt the swelling of the need that the Jewish people has to have people come in contact. So I want to try to explain how each and every one has this and can have it wherever you're going to be ending up in life. Let's start with this bit from the Parsha, which I zerfed over to the office too late. They can pick it up tomorrow if you like. It's there. The first Medrash, the Medrash Rabban, this week's Parsha in Vayetze. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Charana. So the Medrash talks about, applies to this apostle from Mishle, which says, Oz Pelech LaBetach. It talks about how you can walk with surety, with a sense of confidence. It says, this is Yaakov Avinu, that it says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. What's bugging the Medrash? Why is the Medrash plugging this pasuk, applying it to Yaakov? It finishes even that you'll be able to sleep without fear, and Yaakov was Vayishkav Bamokam Ahu, Yaakov lay down and slept. What's going on? So the Mefarshim on the Medrash, but especially the Sfasemis, explains it like this. First, when we look at that pasuk, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Charana, come on, right? If you translate, it's like, and Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and he walked to Charan. It sounds like he decided to do a nature walk or a little tiul. Why doesn't it say, Yaakov's homicidal brother promised to kill him, and he ran for his life to Charan and hid like a bunny there until he would be safe? Right? That's what it should say, right? Even the Sfasemis is Lashon, who doesn't talk about bunnies, but he says, right, he says instead of saying Vayetze Yaakov, should say Vayivrach Yaakov. Yaakov ran. How did this become Vayetze Vayelech? Yaakov's cool. He's in control. He's leaving, and he's going towards his destination. What's happening? What happened to the Vayivrach? So Sema says that Yaakov didn't come to this realization easily. He says, you'll see in the previous week's Pasha, it already talked about Vayetze. And now here it talks about Vayetze. And Rashi explains that there was a two stages to Yaakov's trip. What separated the stages was Hit minatzmo v'yeshiva Hashem v'ever. Yaakov Avinu buried himself in the yeshiva of Hashem v'ever for 14 years. Right? We're familiar with this. What does it mean for a person to bury himself in yeshiva? It's not like when you bury yourself with sand at the beach and you take lots of sperm and pile them up until you only see a little nose and a keeper sticking up. Right? Hit minatzmo, so Semes explains in a very interesting way. Hit minatzmo, to bury yourself, means to dig down deep. Yaakov Avinu went into the depth of the world. He learned to look at things in a deeper way, and that was what enabled him to transform a Vayivrach into a Vayetze. Transforming a Vayivrach into a Vayetze is the key to our sense of shlichus in life that all of us need very, very much. Let me try to explain. There was a story at the time of World War II, just before World War II, that happened in Lithuania. In Lithuania, there was a famous yeshiva of Telz, and it was run at that time by three brothers, the sons of the previous Rosh Yeshiva, the Bloch brothers, Rav Avram Yitzchak, Rav Zalman, and Rav Elio Meir of Achtvog. These three brothers were running the Telz yeshiva. Now, the world in Europe was not the storybook place that we imagined that it was, that everybody was just kind of sitting around singing V'tayr Libenu and being good, but there were all sorts of isms which were sweeping people away from the finest of families and communities. Communism, socialism, Zionism, all sorts of different things were getting people to leave Torah and Mitzvah. So Telz was no exception. And there was a man in Telz who was a communist who decided he would open his store on Shabbos. He did this as a statement. He opened his store on Shabbos, people tried to talk to him, said, no way, right, this is what I believe, this is what I'm doing. So the community eventually organized a protest, a demonstration. Now, at this demonstration, right, they gathered around outside the store on Shabbos, singing Anim Zmiras or something, you know, whatever they did to protest. And a delegation came from the Telz Yeshiva to join the protest. When they came, so the man yelled out at them an insult, right, in Yiddish, an insult for Yeshiva Bachrin, was you call them bunkvetchers. Bankvechers literally means bench pressers. But that doesn't mean guys who work out. It means guys who warm the bench with the appropriate part of their anatomy and are no good for anything else in life. Right? That's the way of saying a bunch of no good parasite bench warmers, right, is basically what it is. So then something happened. It's not clear historically who exactly did it, but somebody slapped the guy. Somebody slapped the guy. And the man pressed a complaint with the police. The police came to the yeshiva. When they came to the yeshiva, Rabbi Meir confessed to doing it. Whether he did or not isn't clear. He said, I did it. They took him to jail for a little bit. Eventually they released him, and they brought him home. Meanwhile, this man became more powerful in town. He became more powerful in the Communist Party, and he let it be known he was planning to get revenge from Rabbi Meir. So the family gathered one night, and they told him, you got to get out of here. It's too hot. This guy could make problems for you. The yeshiva anyway needs somebody to go to America to raise money. Why don't you go to America, raise money, we'll let you know when things calm down. He went to America with his brother-in-law, Reb Mussel Katz, and not long afterwards, the Nazis marched into Telz and killed everyone. Everything was wiped out. Their families, who they had left behind, the yeshiva, the community, was all killed. And Rebbe Meir and Reb Mussel met with other people who had learned in Telz and had escaped those things, and they joined with them to put together the yeshiva, first in Cleveland, and now they have two branches, one in Chicago, one in Riverdale. And they rebuilt the yeshiva. So Rebbe Meir said a very telling thing. He said, if you would ask me, how did I get to America? On one hand, there's a very prosaic, easy answer. I did a vayivrach. I ran. It was this nutty communist guy who threatened vengeance on me and had the power to take vengeance on me, and I ran from him to America. But I won't answer that way because I remember something from Tanakh. We have the story of David and Yonason and Shaul. And Shaul wanted to kill David. And David knew this, but Yonason didn't really believe this. So Yonason decided he would test Shaul. And that was the famous meeting that we read in Haftarah, Machar Chodesh, where he went to the Rosh Chodesh Suda, and he started to defend David to Shaul. And Shaul took a spear and threatened to kill Yonason himself, his own son. And then Yonason came out to David in the field, and he told him the results of his investigation. And this is what he told him. He told him, Lech kishlochacha Hashem. He said, go, because Hashem has sent you. So Rabbi Meir said, I saw that pasuk and I thought about it, and I said, what do you think? It doesn't make sense. Why doesn't he say, go because he wants to kill you? Go because if you stay, you're dead. What is this idea, go because Hashem is sending you? He says, because David understood and Yonason understood that there's a reason behind the reason. If the events in life are pushing you somewhere, who's pushing those events? It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If the events in life are making you go somewhere, and oftentimes these are places you don't necessarily want to go, view it as a shlichus. Kishlachacha Hashem. Those places you end up, and this can be in the very big sense or in the very small sense, is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sending you on your shlichus. And if you have a sense of that shlichus, and if you know that it's there, first of all, it gives you a very different attitude towards some place you don't want to be going. And second of all, it helps you keep your eyes open and to look, what is it I can, could, or should be doing in this place? That's that idea of shlichus. This is what Yaakov Avinu discovered in terms of his Vayivrach, where he had to run away from Esav. Yaakov saw no. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Harana. Shasema says Be'er Sheva represents, the number seven represents this world, the world that was created in seven. Be'er Sheva, the well of Sheva, means the power which is behind this world. There's something behind the events that are happening in this world that move us about in this world like chess pieces on a chessboard. We have to understand it, we have to welcome it, and we have to know to utilize it. And then, if we do that, that's our shlichus. It can happen in all sorts of small places. It can happen in all sorts of small things that can happen, and it can happen in big things. Let's look at a couple of examples. Torah, throughout history, has often traveled to the places it needs to get to because of trips people didn't want to take. Because of pressures and situations that made people do things that they wouldn't have wanted to do otherwise. In history, we know in the beginning of the time of the Rishonim, there were the Arba Shvuyim. There were the four captives. Four great Talmidei Chachamim were taken captive by pirates. They'd been in Italy. Great Chachomim would study in the end of the yeshivas of the Gaonim in Bavel. And the pirates ransomed them off in four different places, three of which we know. One of them in North Africa, one in Spain, and one in Egypt. And when they landed, they were Talmidei Chachomim of such stature, they immediately were able to gather yeshivas around them and to train Talmidei Chachomim and to create Torah, which existed on a high level in those places for centuries. And there are many, many such examples. We have the Shadarim over the generations, Shluchei Derabbanan, people who got sent out from the communities in Eretz Yisrael to raise money, and they would often send the biggest, most impressive Talmidei Chachomim they had, people like the Chidor, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who traveled around the world, and in their travels managed to do tremendous things for the Jewish communities that they came in contact with. Even if we take examples that are much closer to our own life, right, the things that are happening in our world, we all benefit from the Sefer Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Rav Dessler. How did Rav Dessler get to England? He decided he wanted a good cup of tea that he couldn't get in Kelm. Rav Dessler came to England because his father's business was doing poorly and he wanted to get a bit of money for him. And while he came to England, he took upon himself private students who were studying in non-Jewish British schools, and he told them, ask me anything. If you have difficulties, Rav, the Torah relates to these things. And then that brought forth the interesting and fascinating and relevant to us Torah that came about from Rav Dessler that may not have come about had he simply sat in Kelm. It was not a happy trip for Rav Dessler. We see in his letters that when he came to East London, there was barely anybody who appreciated who he was or anyone for him to talk to or teach. Right? These things were difficult. He left his family back in Kelm so his kids would have the chinuch there for many years. He sent his son off back to Europe later to learn and later to America. All sorts of things were going on. These were difficult, horrible times for people. But if we look back at it, we see what resulted. Think of Yaakov's trip. What resulted from Yaakov's trip to Haran? All the shlemus of Yaakov, says the Sfas. He met the women he was supposed to marry. He had the children who became the Yudbei Shiftei Kah. All through that Vayivrach, running, the Medrash says Eliphaz took everything from him. He had nothing. He ran for his life. But he knew that somehow behind it there's a Vayetze, that there's something there which is showing that this trip which is there is something that a person has to do and to understand and to look and to utilize the opportunity. So this creates in our life a very different picture. There was once when I was working for a company, so the company wanted to send me to Germany. And I don't know why I was being such a zealot about it necessarily at the time, but as soon as my boss told me they might want to send me, it was to Frankfurt. So I started saying, I don't know if I'm comfortable with that, you know, with the whole thing, the World War II, the Nazis, this. You know, and I had this imagining in my head that I would come into, you know, this bank and I'd have to work at and there'd be some German there, like, you know, 65 years old or something. And I'd go there and, you know, and I'd look at Fritz there and I'd think, what were you doing in the war, Fritz? And then, you know, I would be there helping his bank run better. It wasn't doing it for me. So I went to speak to my Shishiva, to Rabbi Schechter about it. And he spoke about different things, all about the issue, but then he told me an interesting thing. He says, if you're in this position and your company wants to send you to Frankfurt, he says, think of it this way. He said, there are Jews in Frankfurt. Who are they? What is the state of the Jews there? What are their needs? Can we help them? What is chinuch like in Frankfurt? What are the shuls like in Frankfurt? You, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was sending you there on a shlichus to the Jews who are there. Keep your eyes open. See what can be done. Utilize the opportunity. And a person has to look at this in every single thing which is there. So when a person asks, am I just going to live a boring life of the suburban Jewish housewife instead of going out there and being a heroic shliach for Am Yisrael? No, you won't. Not if you keep your eyes open. Because your shlichus will send you to different things. One day it may send you to a university campus. Another day it will send you to an office. Another day it will send you to a hospital. In each of these places, a person is supposed to go with a sense of shlichus. The events that are pushing me to go places in my life are HaKadosh Baruch Hu sending me places where I'm supposed to be, to do something. Yeah, but how am I going to know what to do? Let's give an example from a famous Chabad story. Right? Just, you know, from the world of shlichim, right? You have to use oftentimes examples from there, even though they are not the exclusive shlichim in the world, as I said. But the most extreme examples you can certainly find there. Somebody told me once a story. He was on a plane. I think it was going to someplace like Spain. And he was sitting next to Lubavitcher. And he says, you're going to Spain? He said, yes. He says, why are you going? He said, the Rebbe told me to go. He says, what are you going to be doing there? He says, I have no idea. I'm sure it will become apparent eventually. he didn't get any details, right? So he assumes, what's he going to do there? So this is another famous story. And again, by the way, I hate having to make this editorial comment, but telling these stories is in no way my taking sides on machloksin about different issues above, within, about, around the Chabad community, but taking examples from their photo. There was one shliach who once got told to go to a certain island in the Caribbean. Not bad, right, for a shliach. Someone gets sent to Siberia, here you go, right? You go to St. Thomas or something like that, off you go to the Caribbean. Okay, so the only problem was, again, no details. He got told to go. Nobody said anything else. And that's the way they work. You're told to go, you go. So he lands there on this island, and he figures, what am I supposed to do? What can I do? All I know to do is to be a Jew, right, to be a Lubavitcher. So I got to walk around as a Jew and a Lubavitcher. So he'd get up in the morning. He didn't see any Jews to put tefillin on, no ladies to give Shabbos candles to, nothing. So he just popped his hat on and walked back and forth in the street all day. So suddenly one lady comes running out of a building, an old lady. She comes to him. She says, you came. He says, you're right. and she says, now I know. She says, I guess so, right? But what is the story? She says that she is a Jewish woman who was living on this island. Her husband had died. As far as she knows, she's the only Jew on the island. She's a widow and she's alone. And the local priest had been coming to visit her, and the priest had been very nice to her and been working on her to convert and explaining to her how good it would be and how good they would be to her, and she would be part of it. And she said, and it was starting to work. She said, so I said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she says, listen, I'm weakening here. If you want me to stick, send me one Jew that I'll be able to know that he's a Jew, and I'm not going to do it. Okay, so these stories, you can take them as you like them, but it's an idea that you often don't know how you do your shlichus. Right, you missed the bus at the Tachanah Merkazit. You went running, you missed the bus, you look in the little electronic thing there, next bus to wherever, next bus to Ranana, half an hour. Okay, that stinks, right? Kapar Zavonas, God punished me, right, whatever it is, right? What do? You're on a shlichus. Come on, give me a break. Honestly, because I'm waiting for a bus. Well, obviously, events worked out for you to be there. Right? This doesn't excuse all stupidity you do in life, by the way. When we get next week to the idea of taking care of yourself, don't simply take every stupid thing you did and say, oh boy, I just made a shlichus. Okay, try and get to your buses on time and such. But nonetheless, right, it'll have a lot to do with utilizing the seichel. Nonetheless, when you're there, and then the half hour passes, and you're looking around, okay, what eternal thing of significance am I going to do here? And the next bus comes and says, I don't think I did anything, right? But maybe you did, right? Maybe there was that Israeli chayelet who was standing there, or chayel more likely, who was watching you, right? And they saw that you bought yourself a Coke, right? And there you are, you said a shahakol before you drank your Coke. And this person looked and saw a certain sweet tmimus and you talking to your Coke before you drank it, right? And they said, voila! You know, that's what I want to be. That's the way my grandfather used to be. That's the way my grandmother used to be. I want to find out about doing that. And those stories happen. Those things are there. Right? Different things happen that send us places. Well, the famous, famous story that came out of Texas. I believe it was Dallas. Right? And it was such a well-known story. The story went that a rabbi of a shul in Dallas was sitting in his office one day. He gets a call from a guy. And the guy says, hello, Rabbi, my name is Lenny. I'd like to make an appointment with you. And he says, okay, we can set a time. Can I ask what the issue is? He said, I'd like to make a large donation to your synagogue. He said, now's okay. I have a free spot right now. So this Lenny comes, and he says, what's going on? He says, I'll tell you, I was just in Israel. I was on a trip, and I went to the wall. It was a very meaningful experience to me. And I saw this guy by the wall, you know, one of those like with the flying saucer and the thing, you know, and everything. He said, and this guy was praying like I never saw in my life. He was there, he was praying, he was pouring tears. I saw somebody who felt the presence of God, who was talking to God. And it moved me. And when I came back to Texas, I thought to myself, I said, I wonder if there's any place here where a guy like that would like to pray. Let's say a guy like that had to take a plane here to this city in Texas. I think it was Dallas, I'm not sure. Right? He had to come would he find a place like that to do his praying thing and shake his, you know, girls there? So I didn't know who to ask, but I know the store sells kosher food. I went in there and asked the guy, and I told him about the guy with this, and I said, where would a guy like that go to pray if he came here? He said, to Rabbi so-and-so's shul. So therefore I wanted to donate. And he not only donated, but he became part of the shul, and he did a lot for building things up. So the rabbi gave an interesting postscript to this. He said, at some point, I had some Yerushalmi guy named Eisenbach, after 120 years, is going to get up to Shemayim. Right? They're going to greet him there when he comes in. And they're going to say, yeah, you're a good guy. You brought up your kids in Torah and all these different things, but especially, right, the community you built in Dallas. He's like, look around. What's in Dallas? Via Dallas. I know, you've never been there. You've never seen it. All he knew was that he was in big trouble. Financial trouble, health trouble, Shalom Bayis trouble, something trouble, and he got himself up and he went to the coastal and he davened. And he built a community in Dallas. We can't know oftentimes what and how that shlichus takes place, but shlichus is there for all of you. Eyes are on you at all times. And it is important, interestingly, for shlichus, it is good to be a little bit visible. It is good. A lot of times people ask me when they go to the university campus or they go to work, they want to know, how much of a profile should I keep? Right? For example, when I was in England once, there was in the office that I worked, there was a guy who was from, and he wore a kippah. And I went down once during the lunch break to ask him something, and he was sitting there with the newspaper, the London Times, right? And I said, you know, David, can I ask you something? Something like, and like, no response. And I, like, you know, looked down over the newspaper. David, he's like, He put it down, he said, sorry, that's how I bench, right? I had them behind the paper, right, so people don't see me benching, because benching is weird, right? So I pretend like I'm reading the newspaper very intently. But imagine if you bench in a way that people see, and people understand that you're a person of benching, and you're a person who's identifiable. So that's something. A person has to be ready for that. To do those things, right, you don't necessarily... And again, I don't have a big issue with the English names or Spanish names, whatever names a person has. But if your name happens to be Sprinter, right, and you don't have to change it necessarily, right, to Kimberly or something when you go to work, right, just because, you know, you're worried about things. It'll stop problems with your parnasa, right? You can go out there and be a proud Sprinter, and then people are going to ask you, you know, what is that thing? And where does it come from? It can be there. It doesn't mean you have to be in your face and start benching, you know, at the top of your lungs and do different things like that. But just be the person who you're supposed to be when you're out there and your shlichus is happening. Look to another Jew. Understanding that every meeting with another Jew is a vital meeting. Sometimes you're the first, sometimes you're the last person who keeps Torah and mitzvahs that that person meets. So what do I got to do? I have to, like, keep, you know, kiruv books in my pocket all the time, kiruv tapes, and, you know, always be ready to pop them out at them? No. What you have to do is to be able to relate to them, first of all, that they will sense, that you sense that it's special to meet a Jew. That they sense that. And that there's an ava there for them because they're a Jew. They'll sense that and they'll meet it. Kreuzberger Rebbe, one of the countless amazing things he did in life after the war, was to found the Lanyado Hospital in Netanya. Right? Kreuzberger Rebbe got this thing into his head. He said, I want to make a hospital. I want to run the hospital. And this became a big joke in the Israeli medical establishment. I read a whole description of how it went. You know, they wrote to him, they said, Rabbi, thank you very much that you want to raise money, right, to support a hospital in Israel. He wrote back, no, I do not want to raise money to support a hospital in Israel. I want to build a hospital, and I want to run the hospital. So there was a certain Talmud of his who was a lawyer who did the running back and forth with the Israeli health authorities. And they said, Rabbi, we understand you're not a doctor. Right? We understand what you want. You're afraid that the hospital will not be run properly in terms of kosher food and Shabbos. So therefore, we will make you the supervisor of the hospital, the mashgiach. And if you have any problems with Shabbos or kashrus, please tell us. Kleisenberg, the Rebbe, wrote back. He said, I don't want to be a mashgiach. Mashgiach is a lousy job because he goes around telling people what things they're doing wrong. Let's flip it around. I'll run the hospital. You supervise it medically. If you're not happy with things that are going wrong, you come to me. It seemed insane, but he did it. He founded the hospital. The whole way this money from the Lanyado family came to him also was very miraculous. And there this hospital was there. So somebody came to the Klezmer, the Rebbe, after the hospital was just started. He said, Rebbe, this is amazing. He said, look at the opportunity we have. We have a hospital. And this hospital is run by us, by the Kloisenberg Sons Hasidim of Netanya. And people come to hospitals, you know what they have? A lot of time. When people come to hospitals, they're waiting online for their blood tests, for their x-rays, for their doctor's appointments. They're lying there in bed, bored and miserable. We've got to pack the rooms with Kiruv tapes and Kiruv books and Kiruv things. We've got to get them. Rebbe said, no, I don't like it. He said, it's missionary tactics. What we will do is treat them so nicely that they'll want to know where that comes from, and then they'll draw close. So that in itself is already an idea of shlichus which is there. This is the sense of shlichus that a person is supposed to have, should have, and it can make the different things you do in life very different. Again, as you think of it yourselves, there are very many creative ways in which people can be shlichim now, even in ways where you don't have to leave your own living room. Partners in Torah, people are familiar with, where they set you up talking on the phone with a Jewish girl in, you know, Anchorage, Alaska, who wants to learn something once or twice a week. Virtually anybody can do it, and there's huge response, and it changes lives in many different ways. Rabbi Wein, I remember, had an idea that a friend of my wife and her husband took very seriously. He said, you know what? There are a lot of communities out there that are small communities, and they can't afford to bring in a kollel or anything like that. But they could use strengthening. Smaller, older communities, like you have in America or some other countries. He says, this is where a person who's not a kollel guy can really rise to the forefront. Because what you can do is you can go to that city as a person working in your field and strengthen Torah as that. So one of the places where this was applied is in Norfolk, Virginia. Norfolk, Virginia had an old Jewish community. And so my wife's friend and her husband, he was an accountant. He had studied in Rabbi Wein's university. So they contacted, they got together a core of young couples who were going there not to be in kollel, not to teach in day school. It wasn't much of a day school at the time anyway, but to go work there. And the community was overwhelmingly welcoming. They helped them find jobs. They helped them find houses. And at night he would learn in the Beis Medrash with people. On Shabbos they would have people. They became powerhouses in the community. And now that community has a kollel and another day school and other things, and they're still there. It wasn't easy. There were many difficulties which were there, but that was an interesting format of these things. But again, what I like to say is that people should look at it not in terms of that. Look at every trip in your life, and especially the trips in your life that you don't want to make as a shlichus. The ones that you do also. Even if it's a vacation, right? Even if you're on a vacation someplace, when you're going there, keep your eyes open. Look, sense, have the sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu sending you. But certainly when you don't want to, you wanted to stay in Israel longer, you weren't able to stay in Israel longer. Don't make it a vayizrach, make it a vayetze. If there's a situation that's not there, you have to move. Let's imagine a hypothetical family. Okay, they're living someplace, you know, in one of the Gan Edens on this earth, I don't know, they're living in Muncie or something like that. And life is good. But then daddy gets downsized, right? Daddy doesn't have a job. They look, where do they find the job? Kansas City. Right? That's it, Kansas City. So you pluck the family up, and you come down to Kansas City. Kids land in Kansas City. Can we have sushi tonight? No kosher sushi in Kansas City. Can we have this? No, nothing, right? There's nothing there. So the kids start complaining. They say, why do we have to come to this loser place? And these things. So the mother could answer. She could say, listen, you want to eat anything? Okay, daddy didn't have a job. Shut up, all right? He got a job. You want to eat? Shut up. And that's the way of looking at it. On the other hand, there's a totally different way of coming to Kansas. He can sit them down, he can explain, you know what, daddy lost his job in the Northeast. We found a job here. We spoke with our Rav. He told us that this was the right decision from a Torah perspective to come here. This means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us in Kansas. Right? Lech yishlachach Hashem. Let's keep our eyes open. Let's have that sense of privilege. When you give a person a sense of shlichus, shlucho shaladim kamosa, a shliach takes on the importance of the one sending him. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the ultimate Mishaleach of all of us. If you want to look at the most universal picture of Shlichus, it's every single one of us being in this world. And the Silsi Sharon says, the Neshama isn't exactly thrilled about coming down to this world. You tell the Neshama, hey, there's Froyo down there. There's Shwarma. There's amusement parks, roller coasters. It doesn't do it for you. But then, when the Neshama comes into this world and sees that its Shlemus can come through meeting the challenges that are here, through the different circumstances and events that it bumps into here, So then that becomes a shleimus. That becomes a shlichus. And then it learns to love the situation that it's in. It learns to love every opportunity. That's why the Vilna Gaon, they say, cried before he was nifter. They said, what are you crying for? You're going someplace good. He said, because I'm leaving a world where I can buy a mitzvah, can buy a tzitzis for a couple of coins and put them on and transform myself and transform the world and transform history. So all of us come here on a shlichus. All of us in our lives are involved in a shlichus. Your coming here is a shlichus. Meeting the people that you meet. It's not by chance. We don't believe that you're all just like a bunch of marbles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu poured into Mechala, right, at random. Every person here from all the different places came here, was guided here in different ways. That means you're supposed to meet and mix and intermingle with the people here, share your experiences with their experiences. Sometimes the connections here will have results for yourself and maybe even beyond yourself 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line. Right? These are things. I have many events in my life that were transformed by people I met when I came to Eretz Yisrael. Right? Many, many, many different things happened there. So if a person, you have to learn to transform fantasy into reality. Right? In the same way that people are excited about Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or something like this, you sit in your rooms up till too late at night reading, you know, up to page 800-something of the latest Harry Potter. Right? And your broomstick still ain't going to fly the next morning. It's just not going to do anything. So what are you getting excited about? My theory is that deep in human nature is the desire to do something exciting and significant, to be on a quest, to be part of the powers of good that overpower the powers of evil. But the idea is don't just let that sit in fantasy land. Realize that these are the real things that a Jew can do in day-to-day life. You don't have to wait for something super storybook special to happen. In the same way, if a person sees that picture of shlichus and it awakens something in you, that idea of being out there, touching all those Israeli backpackers as they come through India, transforming their lives, realize that's not the only place it happens. It happens day to day. It can happen with your own sister. It can happen with your neighbors. It can happen with your friends. Shlichus is there, the events in our life, which sometimes frustrate us so much because we can't really control them in so many ways, but we do have to realize that somebody does control them. And that's his way of putting us on our shlichus. So I look forward to hearing the stories of your shlichus in all the different ways, day to day, year to year, and different things. Hopefully you'll be able to look back at your life in that way and be able to see it. Next week, hopefully, we'll look at how to take care of yourself in your shlichus. You're welcome.